Strategy and Insider, exploring future trends and their impacts.
Hi everyone, and welcome to the 22nd episode of the Strategy and Insider podcast, where we delve into the future of health and explore how technology is poised to reshape healthcare. We are at the cusp of a digital evolution, if not revolution, where digitally enabled diagnostics, treatment, and the management are paving the way for a more personalized, seamlessly integrated healthcare experience. And in each of our episodes, we tackle pressing questions and uncover innovative solutions, ranging from the role of AI in enhancing patient care to the digitization of mental health care and the crucial need for data interoperability. Whether you are a healthcare professional, an industry observer, or simply keen on understanding the future of health, these discussions are a gateway to the profound changes shaping our world. My name is Thomas. I'm the host of this podcast and a partner with Strategy End. 2024 is actually also an exciting year, not only for this podcast, but for us as a firm, because Strategy End is celebrating its 10th anniversary since we became part of PwC's global network. And we therefore took a little creative break with our podcast to come up with even more insightful topics and exciting guests for this very special year. So stay tuned for conversations designed to enlighten and inspire. And today's episode brought me here to sunny Leverkusen, where I'm meeting a very special guest. Welcome, Bijoy Sagar.
Thank you, Thomas. Really glad to be here.
Thank you for having us. And dear listeners, Bijoy is the Chief Information Technology and Digital Transformation Officer, as well as an Executive Vice President here at Bayer. Bijoy is responsible for spearheading Bayer's digital transformation and overseeing the company's IT reconfiguration, as well as guiding the implementation of data-driven processes. His academic background includes a master's degree from the University of Mumbai and the Northeastern University in Boston, as well as a Doctor of Law and Policy in Digital Healthcare from the Northeastern. With regard to his professional track record, Bijoy has over 20 years of working experience in pharma and biotech at companies such as Merck, where he served as their CIO. And before joining Bayer in 2020, he was the Chief Digital and Technology Officer at Stryker, which is a medtech company headquartered in the US. In essence, Bijoy is one of the most proficient digital leaders in healthcare with an evenly impressive task to fulfill, future-proofing a more than 150-year-old company for all digital challenges in the coming years. So really a big thank you for taking the time, Bijoy. I'm more than thrilled to have you as my guest today.
Thank you, Thomas. Thank you for the invitation. I'm really glad to be here. And this is a topic of great interest to me because I think the future of life science in general and healthcare in particular is predicated on what we can do with digital and data.
I love to hear that and very much looking forward to diving into that. And before doing that, probably uncovering you a bit personally, because when you joined Bayer, you shared a personal mission statement on LinkedIn in which you laid out how you perceive your new role. And the posting was titled kind of Digital for a Better World and contains the phrase that technology only has meaning in the context of solving larger societal problems. For you personally, what are the greatest contributions from digital technology for solving such problems? And what do you hope can digitization contribute to further advance a better world?
Thanks. That's a profoundly interesting question. What attracted me to Bayer was the mission statement, health for all, hunger for none. When you look at the context of life science, right, those are two very meaningful social questions we have to address, because three-fifths of the world is still not benefiting from all the advances of technology we are talking about, right? So how can we get to those aspirational mission statements unless we have system thinking in place about it? Whether it's climate change, whether it's food security, whether it's water security, microcredit, all these things are tied together. Because you can't have health and you can't have a life and food security unless you have a system-wide thinking. And what the data gives us the ability today is to connect things that are not obvious to us, right? It gives us the ability to connect things and see patterns. And what's a better way to address this without that?
I love that. And I think what you also bring, and that is intriguing, you are a US citizen who studied both in India and the US, and you also worked in the US for many, many years, but also in Switzerland and now in Germany. And with that international perspective in mind and in your back pocket, if you will, with your experience, what are your experiences with digitizations in those different regions of the world? And what would be kind of a perfect blend of a digital mindset with features from probably all of those countries that you have been visiting?
Yeah, so one of the things that I find very interesting is while the technologies are now spreading more evenly in many places, which was not the case during the Industrial Revolution, right? Mm-hmm. Information asymmetry was the reason why some places developed faster than others. Now, that information asymmetry has been removed to some degree because of the fast spread of internet.
Yeah.
Now, the question is, how do you actually apply these things to get the maximum value for the problems that exist in different places? An example is when I go to Silicon Valley as an example, or Bangalore, a lot of the conversations is about possibilities. Mm-hmm. I'm not necessarily saying that all those dreams can be achieved, at least in the near term, mm-hmm. but it's important to keep dreaming.
Yeah.
Right. And we have a good, healthy ecosystem developing in Berlin, for example, in this area. We have one in Paris. So this is now spreading, right? Yeah. Lots of pockets in the world where there is active thinking about how do we solve these big problems using novel, different approaches. And that's very important to us. So even at Bayer, for example, in the crop science side, the problems of large farmers is very different from that of smallholder farmers. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So we are using India as the way where we are looking at the smallholder farming issues, mm-hmm. because that's a great place to look at that. There are millions of farmers with less than 10 acres of land,
oh,
right?
Wow.
And how do you create a worthy environment for them where they have a marketplace, where they have the skills, where they are looking at the digital approaches? That is very different from going to Brazil or US with tens of thousands of acres, right? Large farms.
Sure. Yeah.
And so same technologies, but you apply them differently. And for me, that's really exciting. Now, talk about pharmaceuticals. Infectious diseases is a big problem in many of the developing worlds, which is not necessarily a problem in the developed world.
Sure.
Right? How do you use genetics, epigenetics, but also environmental factors, right? How do you model it properly so you can solve these different problems very differently? Highly polluted areas, for example, non-small cell lung cancer incidents are going up quite a bit, right?
Absolutely.
How do you model it properly? Because there are lots of things you can say, okay, we understand it, but the more you look into it, the more you realize you don't understand it enough.
Yeah.
So applying similar solutions, but very differently defined solutions that work for the population. That, I think, is the fascinating thing I've taken away from my experience having lived, work, and traveling to many parts of the world.
So solving healthcare issues needs to be a system exercise where you need to have understanding from the various regions to take into account. Likewise, and I'm a big believer of that, by the way, that we will need further convergence of different healthcare stakeholders thinking and acting for the very best interests of humanity and patients at some point if they are getting sick. So also understanding different stakeholder perspectives. And given your background at Stryker, as said, a medtech company, what's your comparison between medtech and pharma companies in terms of their readiness for the new age of data-driven, data insights made medicines?
So until I worked for medtech, I've always been a pharma person, mm-hmm. right? So going to medtech was a very revealing thing for me to learn how the approaches are very different. Mm-hmm. So for one, medtech is still very engineering-oriented area. So the patient intimacy is very different from what is it in pharma, right? Because when you're treating somebody for a bad knee, that's a very intimate, one focused acute event. Mm-hmm. And everything that you do, whether it works or doesn't work, you will know very quickly. right? As opposed to in pharmaceuticals, because you're actually treating somebody for a modality. Mm-hmm. But there are many comorbidities, many complexities. It's a much longer-term play. Mm-hmm. As opposed to in medical devices, because you can continue to evolve the engineering. Mm-hmm. So with data, therefore, it's faster to apply genetic, digital, robotic approaches in medical devices, because you can do many tests, as you will, mm-hmm. through every intervention, as opposed to pharmaceuticals, right? Because you do clinical trials at a mm-hmm. fairly large period before you start going to the market. It's a different methodology.
Setup. Yeah.
The important thing is, how do you take the good lessons out of both of this and marry them together? Because the danger is to think that there's only one way or another way. Mm-hmm. So in our radiology business, for example, in Kelantic, we are mixing both of this. Mm-hmm. So you have the pharmaceutical approach, but you also have the medical device approach. And we are trying to sort of see, how do you apply AI in this engineering methodology mm-hmm. to hopefully predict oncology lesions?
And can I just ask, because you have been now working in both of those areas, right? Are those areas already speaking the same language? Are they kind of converging enough and exchanging enough? Or is this to be improved going forward?
I think there is room for improvement between these two fields. It's partly because they come from two very different scientific traditions. Mm-hmm. Right? Because one is very science-based and very complex science-based, mm-hmm. another is engineering. So there's more trial and error built into it. The time scale is different mm-hmm. as well. But let's take stroke as an example. Right? I want to sort of talk about a particular acute event. Now, stroke has three components to it, right? One is, there is a longer-term biological evidence on who is likely to get stroke, mm-hmm. right? That's very pharmaceutical-oriented, science-oriented thing. But once you have an acute stroke event mm-hmm. it's not that so much. It's quick intervention, mm-hmm. which could always be medical devices as part of the solution. Mm-hmm. Now, you may have a TPA or other pharmaceutical interventions as well. But the third portion is recovery. Because even if you get through that one incident where you can have a device intervention, your long-term predictability of what kind of life you're going to live is the recovery period.
Absolutely. Right?
So you can't just sort of say, I'm going to treat stroke in one way mm-hmm. or another way. You really have to think about all three.
Okay.
And for me, digital is the way you bring these three things together.
It's a perfect segue to one of the questions that I'm intrigued to ask, kind of know your boundaries in order to identify where you need to collaborate. In a recent interview, you shared that you hire people who are very different from yourself, stating that you hire against your weaknesses. I'm intrigued, obviously, to ask, what are those weaknesses and what's the perfect counterpart that would match you best?
Yeah, so, I mean, I have many weaknesses, like everybody.
like everybody,
right?
Yeah.
but I am better at some parts of looking at the problem, right? Mm-hmm. I like, and I think I invest a lot of time in looking for these connections mm-hmm. between things that are not so apparent. But the only way you can have that system thinking is, you also need a lot of people who are then looking at, how do you make it work in smaller pieces as you chunk it down? You need people who can walk into a problem and look at it from multiple angles. So I know which are the areas that I am likely to find in a problem. And those are the things that my mind automatically goes to. But I want other people who would look at it very differently, right? So think of an example is regulations. You can look at a problem and you can mm-hmm. sort of think about, wouldn't it be great if you could do XYZ? Mm-hmm. Then somebody else has to say, yeah, but you have to do that and make it work within that regulatory framework, right? A third person actually has to say, do we have the budget for it? Mm-hmm. So The only way it's going to work is if you have different thinkers who are in the room who can look at different parts of it. So it's not necessarily just the fact that you have one weakness. Of course, you have many. It's about people who are naturally aligned to thinking in different ways. So a good pragmatic solution comes out at the end. And then we're not just dreaming in the cloud. But at the same time, you also can't have situations where people say, no, this cannot be done, and nobody to challenge that, but have you thought about doing it in a different way? That is the mix that I'm always looking for.
I like that a lot, and thanks for opening up on that one. After kind of understood where you're coming from, what you're bringing into the mix, right? I would love to jump into healthcare and pharma and beyond of impact that we're seeing in the years to come stemming from digital data and AI. And recently, ourselves, we have done an AI study where we looked into more than 200 use cases in AI, in healthcare, reviewing them, approximating from that. And what we learned is that through an end-to-end AI usage in pharma, by 2030, we believe you can generate an additional 250 billion euro profit pool, yeah, through taking down costs, but also improving additional business opportunities. And the biggest potential coming from production, where we're seeing 40% of the leverage coming from through better quality machine oversight, outtakes, production optimization, supply chain optimization and the like. Second one being R&D. With about 25-26% through in silico trials, trial optimization as such, but also a good 20% in marketing and sales, contributing to this. Now, with that big opportunity at hand, I'm intrigued to ask, A, what do you believe is the power of AI in healthcare and pharma, which is one. And the second one, and this is something that we discussed also prior to us coming together here today, is there are certain key levers that enable the next gen medicine, especially quantum computing. So those two elements, if you could reflect on A, the power of it, but also the segue that you need or the lever that you need to make it happen, that would be awesome.
So for me, I'm always a little skeptical of these numbers, while I completely believe in the business case. Mm-hmm. And it's because Gartner, for example, believes that a lot of these business cases are built on this block model, mm-hmm. right? You assemble these blocks and you say, if I save 10% out of this and then 10% of the next block, you add it all together. Yes. They instead propose the chemical reaction model, mm-hmm. right? Because chemical reactions don't occur exactly that way. When you add a catalyst, mm-hmm. it can tremendously shift the way you do something, but not always in ways that you can predict, mm-hmm. right? So I think the best of AI is yet to come. Mm-hmm. How exactly it's going to impact these things is still going to evolve. Take GenAI as an example, mm-hmm. right? Of course, the whole world is gone crazy about GenAI.
Oh, absolutely. Right? Yeah.
But we haven't seen the best use cases emerge yet. Mm-hmm. Right? The first use cases often is not the use cases that are going to really make a big difference down the road. Think about internet. Mm-hmm. I came of age when internet became a thing, right? Nobody could have predicted that e-commerce, for example, or media, or travel, the way it disrupted all these things, that is not what anybody was mm-hmm. thinking at that time, right? It evolved over the years. So for me, AI is going to unleash the potential mm-hmm. of the way we do pharmaceuticals. But I don't think it's going to be incremental. Mm-hmm. There is going to be a point which the pivot will happen, which will reset the innovation curve. Mm-hmm. And what will come out of it will be something far bigger and better than we can imagine.
That's very interesting, Bijoy. Bottom line, what sticks with me is AI will have a massive impact. It's too early to tell what exactly this impact is going to be, but it's going to be huge.
Huge. Yeah?
With that said, one of the key levers, and I know that as said from the past, quantum computing will be one of the key levers of making this a reality. Why do you believe this is?
So, first of all, I think most of the big pharmaceutical problems today, these are 1,000-qubit problems, right? These are large problems. Now, at the current error rate, which is about 0.1%, mm-hmm. right? You're talking about, if you extrapolate, you need 100 times that. So mm-hmm. let's say 100,000 to 1 million qubits to run these without error. This is not a realistic proposition, mm-hmm. right? So I think we are at the cusp of another revolution where we are, with software, figuring out how we can reduce the error rate in these transactions to much lower numbers, where 20% more will give us the same level of cohesion mm-hmm. that we need. This is 5 to 7 years out. Right? So this is within the cusp of reality.
Yeah.
Now, if you want to look at cell and genetic approaches to medicine, mm-hmm. right? For 30 years, I've been talking about personalized medicine, right? This might be the differentiator that's going to happen. So I'm excited about it, because when you look at cell-level dysfunctions, right? Methylation, glycation, membrane dysfunction, all of these things. And when you look at actually the gates within the cell that is regulating these, you really need the power of quantum to be able to look at protein modeling, which is a really difficult problem to solve. For simpler materials, we think we are about 3 years out. Mm-hmm. So I am excited about this new way of discovering medicines, a new way of interventions that's going to change the face of how we think about pharmaceuticals. I mean, already we see this, right? In oncology, the new pathways as opposed to chemotherapy, it's much more precise, mm-hmm. much more safe to the body, and it's really helping people live much longer, healthier lives. Now imagine that going to the next level. Mm-hmm. So to me, quantum computing is super exciting, because AI will be able to model larger and larger number of parameters. This is great, as long as we can unleash that data. But where AI is going to hit a certain amount of limitations is its ability to do system-wide modeling that requires the power of quantum. Because just the compute, the transactions that is needed to get that models, especially at the protein level, mm-hmm. that's too complex, mm-hmm. right? So that doesn't mean that we have to wait until that's there to make progress. We want to continue.
It's continuous progress anyway. Yeah.
Correct. But I think cell and gene therapy is going to be the next transformative step in the evolution of human medicines.
Let's hope this is becoming a reality, really, because as you rightly say, people talk about the personalization of healthcare since a while, but I'm also, like you, a true believer. We do have unprecedented disease and health understanding. We have means to measure. If we now have compute power, yeah, that can make data analytics possible that were not possible before, also touching different data sources and data points into one, this is really one of the key levers to making it personalized going forward. So I'm totally with you. Jumping onto AI as such again, and we talked about also generative AI. You touched upon that. Bayer, but also many other healthcare companies are currently actively developing even their own generative AI solutions, like a Bayer GPT, if you will, and Roche GPT and others, which is another step to transform towards becoming a cloud-driven and a data-powered business. Could you explain the relevance of a proprietary AI infrastructure as opposed to relying totally on third-party tools, for instance? And what is the strategy when to do AI initiatives in-house versus leveraging what's out there?
So we call ours Bayer GenAssist. Mm-hmm. Right. The reason to do that is, first of all, as everybody knows, these large language models in public domain, you cannot necessarily trust them in the security model mm-hmm. to put your proprietary data into it. Mm-hmm. Right. So I don't think any responsible company would say, let's leverage that to drive it. Secondly, the compute it takes to get to an answer using a large language model is not financially justifiable mm-hmm. often, right? So I'm of the belief that a lot of small language models, SLMs, which are trained to solve a specific problem, is what is going to give us the best bang for the buck mm-hmm. at the right level of compute. Right. Then you get to a point, and I think some of the colleagues outside of pharma, so in banking, for example, are now working with multi-agent models, where the agents from these different small language models can teach each other. So instead of the human in the middle, they have agent in the middle, mm-hmm. right? These sort of connected models of small language models will actually get to the right problem with far fewer data requirements and lower compute requirements. So it's a natural thing that we want to get there. We want to expose APIs of our systems mm-hmm. all into our internal generative AI model. Mm-hmm. We've already added about 120 APIs into it.
Okay.
Right? And we'll continue to build this out because that's the only way we are going to create prompt generation. To some degree, we are crowdsourcing it mm-hmm. in the sense that after we do this and we develop the prompts, we are trying to see which ones are actually getting used. Instead of us saying, no, let's do these three things, that's the right business case. For example, one of our prompts already has 15,000 people using it internally.
Wow. Right?
Clearly, this is something that is meeting an unmet need and mm-hmm. we want to scale it up. Others may not happen that way. Mm-hmm. So us, this is a no-brainer the way we would do it. As much as possible, using a lot of the public domain large language models, creating SLMs, training them with the data you have internally, marrying them to the external data where needed, all of these are equally needed. Mm-hmm. Now, it wouldn't surprise me 2-3 years later. We are back in the war for chips because there's going to be a question where you would ask hyperscalers, of course, we are going in that route today, right? Tomorrow, do you really want to prioritize your own compute? Mm-hmm. That may happen, right? I'm still observing that in the market to see which direction is that going. But in the end, I think people who have the best approach architecturally is going to win this battle. Not necessarily the one with the largest amount of data mm-hmm. or the most powerful compute.
But the smartest way to handle it. Okay, interesting. And another use case next to Genesis that you are internally using a lot already, you announced as Bayer last year a collaboration with Google Cloud to drive early drug discovery and also with the aim of accelerating development cycles. The aim is to leverage high-performance computing like AI and machine learning to increase the processing power needed for simulating interactions between an active ingredient, an API, in new drugs. Yeah? Can you please tell us a bit more how that collaboration helps making R&D faster? And if there are already some even new medical compounds, without naming them, of course, that are discovered as a result of this?
So the primary aim of collaboration like that is to learn.
Okay.
Right? Because high TPU computing is going to help us solve chemical problems, mm-hmm. which you can't solve conventionally. And we are already seeing positive early results out of that, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. right? Especially how do you develop an algorithm, right? For different types of computing environments is different, right? And that's very important to do mm-hmm. because how the threading happens within the computer architecture is going to influence how you write that algorithm.
Sure.
And those are the things that we want to learn and learn early because that's going to help us set the journey in the right place. So we're very excited about the partnership. But you also have to temper these things to know that these are long journeys. So you can't be disappointed by early setbacks, nor can you get super excited by a few promising yeah. journeys. You have to have a fair amount of patience to deal with these journeys because this is the game of innovation to begin with.
Absolutely. Right?
Secondly, you have to apply this for the right problems. Mm-hmm. So if you're looking at boundary conditions, problems that deal with boundary conditions, they yield to a certain kind of approach, like in this case, than if you're looking at random forest simulations, for example, where I probably would not apply this model. So it all depends on what is the problem you're trying to solve, mm-hmm. how likely is it that you can actually solve it within the budget constraints you have, and then what are the lessons you're learning. As long as you hit all four of it to certain degrees of success, I think it's a success.
As as we touched upon making healthcare more personalized through the usage of AI, small or large language models, healthcare is also at the brink of being more and more preventative. Yep. And with more and more people developing in a desperate interest in living healthier and probably also longer, longevity is the key word here. I know Bayer, but also as other companies who are actively involved in personal health monitoring and also longevity, how do you personally assess the potential of digital tools in promoting longevity, and where do you see probably also limits?
This is a very interesting, intriguing and difficult question to answer, right? For one, I think, for example, as you have seen, we had a partnership with Hurdle that we got into it. I'm very excited about it. Lots of other companies are trying something similar, right? This is really important because you have to learn through these processes. There are different approaches, right? So you basically, how do you use biomarkers? How do you use the right sensors? And how do you calibrate? This is the name of the game. But let's think about longevity in the micro and macro environment. Because when you look at the micro, everything from mitochondria all the way up, and epigenetics and the environmental factors, this is what we were saying earlier, right? How do you actually address that? Now, that's a really difficult problem. The macro problem is the population health. And you have a tremendous amount of data. So without even getting to that level of detail, you are still generating a lot of data that you should be able to look at with the sensors to figure out what is your biological age, what is your proclivity to be susceptible to a particular disease state, right? Or a metabolic disorder that can eventually predict other disease states, right? For example, if you have pancreatic dysfunction, even though there may not be a direct genetic line that way, but stroke or cardiovascular complications down the road is easily, you can see through that. These things can be modeled today, right? But the thing that I'm also excited about, it's not just about your biological age. Most of the markers and most of the ranges developed today are based on very small patient sizes. Why do we say the healthy LDL level is X? It's based on reasonably small patient sizes at some point. And then as patients got unhealthy or the general population got unhealthy, your acceptable window, because you're looking at a bell curve, also became bigger. That doesn't mean it's a healthy window. That just means that now the broader population is unhealthy, so the window increased. All of these things you can address using these methodologies. So this is where I think the partnership is internal, of course, because you have a tremendous amount of skills internally in pharmaceuticals, but we don't know everything, right? External, so this is a startup ecosystem because they are willing to take a problem and run with it and test it. I think that's a great method. And academic, because they are now looking at the problems in their sort of pure way. It takes all three, plus the regulative landscape where you can free a lot of this population health data so we can apply these findings to it to really look at wellness and better way to get outcomes. We normally treat diseases, right? We don't treat the metabolic conditions that the body is going through. For me, my passion personally is how do we really use genetics to get to that so you get better outcomes.
And to be honest, I can see, of course, your passion. But also, I think listeners can hear that passion. And it's, I think, fair to conclude that science is unprecedented, data available like never seen before, compute power at the brink of scaling, partnerships in place, openness to collaborate with each other. It's fair, I think, to say we will see eventually great innovation to come in disease care, but also in healthcare. I was recently talking to someone in the biotech space, having a profiling startup founded and doing a lot of super interesting, innovative science-based innovation. That innovation needs obviously a regulation system that allows for that. Yeah. And we had a vivid dialogue around what to regulate and what probably it is too early to regulate in some of the instances. But adding to that, another essential aspect of innovation and ongoing digitization is what people call the ethical utilization of AI in these days. And there are certain risks associated with the possibilities of AI, ultimately leading to the conclusion that probably not everything that AI can do, it should do. For example, the European Union, as one of the world's first regions to develop a legal framework on AI, will bring out a regulatory guideline for a trustworthy AI that respects fundamental rights, safety, and ethical principles, as they say. What is your personal perspective on balancing the opportunities and risks of AI, particularly in healthcare?
So, number one, I think, of course, you need regulations.
Absolutely.
And you have to work within the framework of regulations. But there's a philosophical component to this discussion.
Mm-hmm.
I believe that the answer to bad AI is more AI.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason is because a lot of the human bias that is introduced into AI, that will only go when more AI happens, right? So you have a lot more algorithmic model and data approaches that cancel the human intervention out.
Mm-hmm.
But if you reduce that, the human biases will persist. For me, the worst way to introduce corrections is manually correcting human biases with intended consequences, because mm-hmm. then you have no idea what the unintended consequences of that is. And you have seen this lately with a lot of AI models that have been released, because unintended consequences may be equally bad.
Mm-hmm.
You wouldn't know that until after some time, right? So for me, how do you work within the ambiguity? Because a lot of the new AI models, by design, would be black box, because the only way you get to the maximum potential of that. So how do you get to that where you can leverage the power without running afoul of human rights and, mm-hmm. and equality and all the other things we want out of it? And how do you do this in a way, again, which is manageable from a compute perspective? Because in the end of the day, I'm always thinking about that. Anything is possible if you have unlimited amount of money, data, and resources, which nobody does. So I would obviously love to see this thinking evolve
mm-hmm.
more
mm-hmm.
in all jurisdictions,
mm-hmm.
because regulating fully before we fully understand mm-hmm. the consequences can backfire. So we need to continue to have this dialogue in
yep.
all locations among all experts, because everybody brings a bioethicist would look at this problem very differently than a computer scientist. You need to hear from all quarters here as you build this out.
And this, you mentioned something super important, the word dialogue. I don't think regulation you can have as static as you had them in the past, because the field of data science is evolving so rapidly. A regulation today might not be the regulation in a year, in 3, and surely not in 5 years
Correct.
From now.
Correct.
And that ongoing process of staying in touch and kind of always course correcting on the way to it will need to be the new normal, I
yeah,
assume.
Absolutely. I mean, look, there are human interests, right? In some cases, we have to recognize that technology that excludes human interests will mm-hmm. never succeed. So in some cases, you can ask yourself, where do you limit the technology because it's not in line with the human interest?
Yes.
Then you have to sort of say, are we looking at the right human interest?
Mm-hmm.
So for example, in economics, the principle of rent seeking, mm-hmm. right? Is that the right human interest? Or is it really to move innovation forward?
Mm-hmm.
For example, fighting cancer,
mm-hmm.
right? And thirdly, is regulation in keeping with what is possible?
Mm.
Either you're regulating for yesterday, then it doesn't make any sense,
yeah.
or you're regulating for tomorrow, which you can't predict.
Mm.
So I recognize it's a really difficult thing to do and get it right. That's why we have to keep the eyes open here and be willing to have the dialogue. But the most important thing, so I keep saying, is the answer to bad AI is more AI.
And that was, I noted that down actually. That struck me really. I like that phrase, to really outlive the bad AI that we have potentially then experienced by that time. Coming to one final question around, you were once describing the digital transformation at Bayer as a threefold endeavor, which consists of building new business models like digital farming, digitizing internal processes, and creating the supporting infrastructure with a cloud-based environment. Where do you stand in this transformation in each of those dimensions? What would we still need to discuss if we would, let's say, re-record another podcast episode in 5 years?
So number one, I think we are making progress in all three, right? So as we already discussed, yeah, Bayer has digital farming as an approach, Kalantic as an approach. Mm-hmm. The new business models are out there flourishing. They are testing their hypotheses through, right? So that journey is ongoing. Mm-hmm. The digitizing of our processes and the solutions that we are putting in place is already working. I was very happy to have been at Uberlandia last year in Brazil. Mm-hmm. And have the farmers say, I'm now using 30% less resources because of the digital algorithms. To me, that made me extremely happy because it's tied to our mission, it's tied to our customers, it's tied to our farmers that we are supporting, because again, technology is not for technology's sake. So that's happening. None of this is possible without the cloud infrastructure. So we were the first in Europe at our size mm-hmm. to complete the cloud transformation last year, right? So we have no data centers left in Bayer anymore. We have ensured that the lack of access to compute is never the reason why we can't innovate. That problem has been largely solved. 5 years from now, if you're having this conversation, we probably would still be talking about these three things because they would have evolved further. Uh-huh.
At right? a different level
At
then.
At different yeah. levels. Uh-huh. But it's not even different levels. Like I said earlier, I'm a big believer of, if you have read the book Innovator's Dilemma,
yep.
right? At some point, you have to change the curve, mm-hmm. the shape of the curve, the structure of the curve, and we'll be hopefully talking about where in that curve are we, and there we would still need to be doing all of this all over again, right? Who would have thought about NVIDIA's chip shortage and how they are talking about compute as the biggest problem? 5 years ago, we were not having that conversation, yeah. right? 5 years ago, we were not talking about Gen AI as what it is today.
Yeah.
So 5 years from now, I would predict we are probably talking about quantum, but I could be completely wrong. There will be a third thing that comes out that we don't know where it is, or something has matured. So I don't think the conversation mm-hmm. topic is that is going to evolve. It's the content of the conversation that's going to evolve. But any industry that doesn't think about the innovation curve is in trouble.
Yeah.
And the good news about life sciences is that the innovation curve is still yielding results. It's not a highly mature area today, right? Unlike some other industries. So that gives some constancy in how you want to apply resources and how you want to move this journey forward. I am very excited about the future because I really think best is yet to come.
What a great ending, Vito, I have to admit. I'm equally excited about that future and seeing this happen month by month, year by year, and reaching different levels will be to be watched, and I'm certainly very much looking forward to. So big, big thanks for the great and very vivid dialogue that we had, and also thanks for sharing some personal examples that you brought in today. Really appreciate of that. And yeah, dear listeners, I do hope that you found it at least as interesting as I did, and thanks very much for tuning in to the Strategy and Insider podcast today. Don't forget to subscribe and leave us a review on your favorite podcast platform. We do appreciate your support and look forward to bringing you more thought-provoking episodes in the very near future. Until then, stay safe and stay tuned.
Thank you for having me, Thomas.
Strategy and Strategy made real.